This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I don't know the truth!
Hello, welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover, and look, we're having a national conversation about policing right now. And the main content of the conversation is this question: what are the police for? Like, seriously, what the fuck are they actually for? Let me tell you a quick story from my own experience to sort of break down how I think about the issue. Back in the before times, when I was still a stand-up comedian instead of a full-time Zoom user, I finished a set. And I was walking back home from Hollywood at around 11 p.m. And I passed a woman who was walking around barefoot with a blanket over her shoulder. She appeared to be unhoused. And she was yelling, "Help! Help!" on the sidewalk. And I was a little alarmed. I stopped and I said, "Ma'am, what kind of help do you need?" And her answer wasn't quite lucid. She was clearly mentally ill and in need of services. And I'm just some guy walking home. I don't have the training or the resources to help her out. But so I keep walking. And about half a block later, I reach a subway station. And in front of the subway station, thankfully, are two police officers. I think, this is amazing. I found the exact people I needed to find to help this situation. Surely they can help. I tell them, "Officers, there's a woman just up the block, and she's shouting for help." And their response was a little bit troubling. They laughed in my face and replied, "Oh, no, we can't help her. She's just crazy." As though that were a reason to not help, rather than the exact reason she needed help. Also, you know, it was January in LA, she was barefoot, and she was also the only fucking thing happening on the block. There were not any jewel thieves trying to knock over a diamond distillery or whatever. That was all that was happening. Why could the cops not help her? And if they can't help her, why were they there? What is the point of them? Why don't we have, by contrast, say, a network of social workers and mental health intake workers patrolling the streets, talking to people who need that kind of help? Because people in LA do need that kind of help. On my average walk to work, well, back when I used to walk to work, I would see an average of a person a day who needed care like this. And the stats back this up. An article in the Journal of Health Affairs puts it like this: Los Angeles might be more affected by the twin crises of homelessness and mental health neglect than any other U.S. city. 30% of those on the streets here have a substance abuse or mental health disorder, yet we use the cops to manage them. In fact, a huge number of our police incidents involve unhoused people or people with mental illness. But guess what? Those are problems you can't police away. You can't tase them. You can't zip tie them and send them in the drunk tank. Those are problems that cannot be solved with force. They require care. So why are we spending so much money on force rather than care? LA spends $3 billion out of its $10.5 billion a year budget on police. Police are the single largest item, despite the fact that crime is at a 30-year low. So surely there is a better allocation of resources to address the problems that we actually have. But here's a follow-up question. What are cops thinking? Like, what is going through their minds when they're not helping that woman screaming for help on the streets of Hollywood? Or what is going through their mind when they are brutalizing protesters or kneeling on the neck of a person of color? What causes them to behave this way rather than helping us in the ways that we need help? And what stops them from speaking up about it? I mean, you can find 5,000 op-ed posts about why people left their publishing jobs. Why is it so rare to hear a police officer say anything bad about the police force, to expose any of the ills in our broken policing system? Well, to answer that question, I wanted to go right to the source. I wanted to find a police officer, a former police officer, who could speak with us honestly and openly about what it is like to be an officer in America and why he left the force. And we have the perfect guest to talk about that with us today. You might have seen him if you saw our episode, Adam Ruins the Cops, which, by the way, if you haven't seen it and you want to learn something about policing in America and what is so wrong about it, check it out. You can find it on demand or on Amazon. If you don't have access to either of those things, I don't know, you can probably also find it on BitTorrent. You have my blessing, go BitTorrent it, okay? He's a former Baltimore City police officer, and he is here today to share his story and to tell us what really goes through the minds of police officers on the beat and what we need to do to reform policing in America. Without further ado, please welcome Larry Smith. Larry, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a little while since I've seen you on the set of our episode, Adam Ruins Cops, we did together.
Yeah, like a year and a half, I guess, by now.
The topic has only gotten more relevant in the time since.
Unfortunately.
You're a former Baltimore police officer, and Baltimore, of course, has had its own, let's say, struggles in this area. But how do you think about what we've seen going on across the country in recent weeks, about both the protests in, you know, Minneapolis and around the country and the police response to them?
Well, I think the protests themselves are much different. And I mean, they're spread out not just across the country, but across the world. I mean, you're seeing huge protests in London and Paris and just in cities across America that you know, haven't even had maybe like national press coverage for specific incidents. But it's just an outpouring of support all over the country. And they're sustained. I mean, they don't seem to be going away at all.
Yeah.
The police response is deplorable. I mean, it's you see cops that are shooting reporters with pepper balls, with rubber bullets. I've seen at least three or four photojournalists who have lost an eye because they've been shot with projectiles. And you just see peaceful protesters being subjected to, you know, brutal force and the use of chemical weapons. And it's clear that the police have like dug their heels in even more, you know, and I think it just goes to show you that they have no intention or interest in reforming policing.
Do you have any insight into when you're watching, you know, that footage? I mean, this is one of the incredible things about these protests is that they've created video evidence of the exact thing that the protesters
right.
are protesting against, or at least a very similar thing. When you watch those cops, do you have any insight into like, hey, here's what they're thinking, or here's the dynamic that creates this? Because to a lot of other folks watching, it's shocking. Hey, why the hell would they respond this way?
Well, sure. I went through it in 2015 after the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. So in 2015, you know, you had, you've got Eric Garner, like at the end, I think it's at the end of 2014. And then you have Michael Brown and Freddie Gray in 2015. So you have three real high profile cases, you know, back to back. And Baltimore, you know, the protests had been building even before Freddie Gray was killed. So after he died and after his funeral, you know, we were already in sort of this mindset of everyone is against us being the police. And I know all these cops go to roll call. I know they're all tired. I know they've all had days off canceled, vacation canceled. You know, every cop would, I'm sure, rather be at home than be out for 14 or 16 hours a day. But I think the most important point is that when cops go to roll calls or they prepare for these protest details, you know, there's a commander, there's an FOP president who is literally brainwashing you to think that everyone out there is there to hurt you, to harm you in some way. So it's, you know, cops are going into these protests with a mindset of, you know, they don't like us, they want to hurt us. And it's almost like, well, we're not going to, I mean, as cops, we're taught, we don't sit and wait to be hurt. So they're using force. I mean, they're literally, throwing the first punch.
And I can't help but think it has something to do with what the protests are about. I mean, I was at the Women's March in, early 2017, and there weren't pepper balls out. You know what I mean? It was a different event in a different context, but also, like, it seems like part of it must be because of the protests are about policing.
Well, right, of course. And I think that is made obvious when just, what, like 2 weeks prior, you have armed militia members who will, you know, storm into a state house in Michigan because they can't go sit at the Olive Garden or get haircuts. And the cops just sit there and let them yell and scream and protest. And there's no tear gas. There's no pepper balls. There's no baton strikes. And these guys have assault weapons. But as soon as the protests turn to, you know, quote unquote, anti-police sentiment, then, yeah, it's like no holds barred.
Tell me a little bit about your story. Why did you initially become a cop, and what led you to finally leave?
The why did I become a cop question, I get a lot, usually because people are like surprised to learn I was a cop, and I have no like really great answer. Like, there was nobody in my family was a cop, so I wasn't like, you know, following in anybody's footsteps. You know, my dad wasn't exactly law abiding, so it's not like I was like, oh, let me, you know, go be a cop. But I mean, the reality is I was 24 years old. I hadn't gone to college. I was working in a bookstore, and I was like, I got to do something.
And need a job.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, civil service tests, like, you know, cops, firefighters, stuff like that. You can take a test. You can get hired. They pay well. They have a retirement. They have benefits. So, and you don't really, honestly, you don't need much more than a high school diploma.
I mean, that's got to be why so many people sign up for them. I mean, it's one of the only jobs in America today that still has a pension.
Yeah, I mean, some departments are actually, I guess, phasing out like the classic pension. But yeah, they all have some form of a retirement. You know, as far as why I left, I mean, I'd been there for 18 years. Baltimore City is a city that has been plagued by poverty and addiction and violence for decades. And I mean, I lived a fairly sheltered middle class life before I came to work in Baltimore City. I had never seen or experienced anything like it. And 18 years of, I mean, seeing the worst things you can imagine, it adds up. And there was also just, you know, the stress of, I spent 3 years in internal affairs. So I was investigating dirty cops.
Wow.
And I had a couple run-ins with some of those cops. And some of them actually wound up being federally indicted in 2017. So there was, yeah, just a lot of stress, a lot of things going on. I had really kind of had a hard time reckoning with the job that I had been a part of. And I had some serious mental health issues. I ended up in a psychiatric facility for 10 days. I had a couple suicide attempts. So mental health is really stigmatized in policing as well, which I think is another huge problem. A lot of untreated mental illness. And I had to get out of it. I mean, I was gonna kill me one way or the other, so I had to get out of it.
What kind of, like, I'd love to dwell on this for a second if you're comfortable with it, because the when I look at the footage and when I think about these officers, I think about, like, you know, people have this conversation about, you know, bad apples, good apples. Is that a proper way to look at it? And I look at the situation, I'm like, I think if you put me in there
in the same situation, I think I would start reacting that way too. Like, I think that I look at the behavior. I'm like, this looks like something that's like done to you. It looks like it changes your frame of mind, your way of interacting with the world. And that's why, you know, we need not just reform, but like systemic change. That's what it looks like to me on the outside. I'm wondering if you have insight on that.
Well, the bad apples, you know, no one ever really finishes it. It's a few bad apples ruins the whole bunch or something like that.
Right. So,
and it is, it's really, the mindset in a police department is really contagious. It's almost like a cult. You know, you're really indoctrinated into believing a lot of things. And especially now, like post 9/11, there are a lot of ex-military who come back and become cops. I mean, it's sort of like a natural career progression, mm-hmm. I think, for a lot of guys. So again, that I think mental illness also factors into that, because you may have a lot of guys coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq who have untreated PTSD, undiagnosed PTSD, and now they're becoming cops. You know, I saw a lot of guys who came from the military who patrolled the streets of Baltimore like they were patrolling in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Like they were on the lookout for, and, you know, whatever, insurgents or people were the enemy. Like everyone was a potential enemy. And add that to, we're pretty much already taught that. We're already taught to be on our guard with everyone. So the combination of that is just the perfect recipe for violence. Especially when people challenge you and your mindset is, I don't want to be challenged, or I should not be challenged. So yeah, and again, it's definitely contagious. Like if you're a part of that, if you stay for a long time, you know, you become numb to a lot of things. So when you see other cops doing stuff they shouldn't do, you know, while you may not actively participate in it, just your silence makes you as guilty as what they're doing.
Are there, like, you know, when you look back at your time, do you ever think like, wow, I can't believe I was in that headspace. Like what a strange way to think that was.
Oh, I mean, I left the department in 2017, July of 2017. So not even 3 full years yet. But I think about that literally every day. I have the hardest time coming to terms with the fact that I did it, and I did it for 18 years. Like, yeah. No one forced me to stay. I could have left at any point. But yeah, I mean, there are specific incidents. There are things I saw, things I participated in, things I did that I definitely am like, you know, why, like who, I don't even know who it was. Like, and I know that kind of sounds like maybe like I'm trying to make excuses for myself, but you know, I really don't. Like, I can't believe I was that person.
Well, you were there for 18 years. That's as good enough a reason to leave any job, frankly. But you, unlike most cops who retire, became a critic of policing and how we police America. You write about this issue. You're very vocal about it, about your personal experience. That is so incredibly rare. When we had you on our episode, Adam Ruins Cops, I was like, I told our staff, I was like, we need to find a police officer who is able to talk about this, because that's the, like, sort of the strongest perspective. And you're the only one in America who we found, at any rate. Why do you think that's so rare? And what caused you to take that step?
Well, why I think it's rare is again, the, like, I compared it to a cult. I mean, imagine people who leave. I don't want to name any specific.
But there's more former Scientologists who have written books about Scientology than there are cops who are, you know, denouncing policing.
Right. Okay. But Scientology is a perfect example, because I mean, you see examples of, you know, people who do speak out are harassed. You know, they're harassed. They're excommunicated.
Absolutely.
Right. So now, use that scenario with cops who have guns, the ability to take your freedom away, to put you in jail, to frame you for God knows what. I mean, I worked with a whistleblower. I saw firsthand a cop who spoke out against brutality and wouldn't get back up on calls, had a dead rat left on his car, you know, who was harassed, who was basically run out of the department. And it's a very lonely island to be on. You know, there's a case in New York City where I think it was about 10 or 12 years ago, an officer tried to blow the whistle on his commander's giving quotas for stats. And he had his apartment raided, and he was forcibly removed and taken to a mental hospital where he stayed for like 4 or 5 days. Wow. So, I mean, that's the retribution. I mean, that's what you risk when you speak out. And
they
cops
him
know
as
this.
As retribution.
Yeah.
Wow. What? So, well, that leads me to the other part of the question, which is what made you do it?
Because I was just tired of it. I mean, I left and I mean, yeah, like I was definitely bitter. You know, I would have had to have stayed for 25 years to earn my pension. I stayed 18, so I missed it by 7 years. So it's not like I was like, oh, I'm, you know, like whatever cop movie, like, oh, only 2 days away from retirement. But at the same time, I was like, you know, I put 18 years into this, and it completely made me miserable. Like, I, you know, from April 2016 until June of 2017, I literally thought about killing myself every single day.
Wow.
And that takes a toll on you, man.
Yeah.
So I mean, I was pissed. I would, you know, and I've been accused of having an axe to grind, of being bitter, and yeah, all of that, sure. And I'm tired of anytime the police do something wrong, you know, mainstream media, politicians, cop apologists, cops themselves, police unions, they automatically run to defend the cop. I mean, mainstream media will play such word salad when it comes to police killing somebody. You know, police involved shooting. They discharge their weapons. It's like they will drive 10 miles to tell you the cops killed somebody.
Right.
So I just got tired of it. I mean, that's plain and simple why. And it started on Twitter. I mean, it started on social media, and then somebody contacted me and asked me if I wanted to write something, and I had never written. I was like, oh, okay, sure. That's how I learned the beauty of having an editor who can actually make me sound somewhat coherent. So that's just kind of took off from there.
Have you experienced like retribution of the kind that you mentioned since?
I mean, I've definitely been trolled on social media. I haven't had any visits to my house. No, I mean, I haven't had anybody visit me or call me or anything like that, but I'll say it's definitely always in the back of my mind. Like if I say the wrong thing, or I'm very careful about criticizing someone specifically, like cops I knew in the Baltimore Police Department who are still working, who are dirty, that I know from my time in internal affairs. And I'm very careful not to, I guess, out them, but you know, I know they're there, but at the same time, you know, I don't have the courage to, I mean, I really don't even know what to do about it, quite honestly. I mean, I could name them, but where does that put me? I mean,
yeah. Can you say, like, in terms of dirty, can you say the type of dirty that you mean, or you can even extend it to other police departments? Like what sort of, what are the sort of forms of corruption, I assume you're talking about, that occur?
Excessive force, stealing, planting evidence, lying in search warrants, lying in statements of probable cause. And you know, I've hooked up with a couple public defenders in the area. I've talked to activists. So, you know, like these guys, it's not exactly a secret who these guys are. I mean, some of them have been taken to court over their internal affairs records, which are protected not just in Maryland, but in many states and jurisdictions, personnel files are protected. So lawyers have to fight to gain access to a cop's personnel record. So there are definitely cops that are, you know, it's like an open secret that they're dirty. Unfortunately, it's just like you sit around and wait for them to get caught. But in the meantime, how many lives are they ruining?
Yeah. Were you able to
make any progress on that in internal affairs? Was that an effective system at all for stopping that kind of behavior?
No, not at all. Internal, I mean, I think, and again, I can only speak specifically for my department because that's where I have the experience, but just in general terms, police investigating other police is just a bad idea. I think it's just set up to fail from the beginning. You know, I had cases where I investigated people I knew, people I worked with. I watched other people investigate their friends. You know, I saw cases that were pretty much a slam dunk. The cop did it. The cop committed, you know, the allegation or was guilty of the allegation he was accused of. But they had their friend investigating them, and it just went away. You would see like upper level command interfere with investigations. So the system itself is just completely flawed all over. I don't think, you know, and you're seeing it right now with, especially with cops who are for whatever reason are deciding that their food orders being tainted is like the new urban legend that we're going to go with.
Yeah. So all these cases have been debunked by journalists and by everyone who's looked into them.
Yeah, like almost immediately. But you always see the same reaction where from the police departments themselves, like, well, we're going to conduct an investigation. It's like, okay, well, the police are going to investigate the other cop. So great.
Yeah. And you see, by the way, in those cases, the same exact thing with the media, where the media reports two cops poisoned at a Shake Shack, like over and over again, when this is a completely false claim that's based in nothing at all.
Right. Well, I mean, and unfortunately, I think that's a product of the immediate news cycle, especially with, mm-hmm. you know, Twitter and Facebook, where, you know, media outlets don't want to be the last to report something. But in the process, you know, they don't vet things properly. And so they just get them out there and it becomes fact before it's even actually investigated or, you know, like you said, they're debunked pretty much right away.
Well, and so let's talk about the issue at hand, racism in policing and systemic racism. What of that did you see in your time? I mean, certainly Baltimore has had its fair share of that over the years. How does that look in practice? Did you have that sense firsthand when you were working there?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I patrolled predominantly black neighborhoods. And Baltimore has quite a few areas like Roland Park, Guilford, Canton, Fells Point that are upper class, that are predominantly white, wealthy neighborhoods where the police don't go. So, you know, in terms of things like community policing or bias or things like that, you know, we're already being told that these neighborhoods are the bad neighborhoods. And so what are the bad neighborhoods? Well, they're sending us where only people of color live. So we basically end up being like an occupying force in these communities. And the community doesn't have any say in it. They can't ask us to leave. I mean, they can, but no one's going to listen to them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, imagine as like a middle-class white person, what your perception of the police is. Like, do you walk outside your door and see the police every day? Like literally every hour?
No.
Now, if you're a person of color in Baltimore and New York City and Chicago, Los Angeles, you know, there are communities where people walk outside their doors and they see the cops on foot. They see them in cars. They see them on bikes and they see them 24/7. And they know they're going to be stopped for, I mean, anything or nothing. If the police want to stop you, they're going to stop you.
Yeah.
You know, who are we keeping safe? Like, are we keeping the white neighborhoods safe because we're containing the quote unquote bad neighborhoods? So yeah, I mean, that's obviously a racist system. Like, if we're being utilized only in neighborhoods that are predominantly black and brown citizens, and the white citizens never see us, but yet they somehow feel safe. How is that not a racist system?
I mean, why do you think we have that system? Like, there's a decision being made on some policy level. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think it comes from politicians and police commanders and police officials who think that the way to fight crime is to patrol, again, what I refer to as high crime neighborhoods. But if your only answer is to address high crime with the police, it's never going to get any better. If your only answer to every societal problem is the police, it's not going to get better.
Yeah.
So yes, there where I worked, the primary job was the drug trade. Okay, well, but why are guys getting into the drug trade? Because there's no opportunity.
Yeah.
Because you're interacting. I mean, we have school police in Baltimore City. So it's like, you know, there are citizens who are interacting with the police from like the minute they're born, basically.
Yeah.
So at some point they get arrested. Now they have a record. So it's like, you know, everything's already stacked against a lot of people.
Yeah.
So if you don't have a lot of opportunity, if the city is if your neighborhood is impoverished, the schools are bad, you don't have access to clean water and healthy food, or the, you know, there's no job opportunity, there's untreated addiction and mental health issues, you know, what are you supposed to do? We're in a capitalist society. You have to live. You have to feed yourself. So the drug trade, you know, I don't think guys are lined up like, yeah, I want to sell drugs.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's that's the opportunity. And it, so, and, but it, again, if the only way to combat that is to criminalize everything and to keep treating the problem with the police, we don't improve anybody's life.
Yeah. It's also clearly not working. I mean, like, we have these neighborhoods that are called high crime neighborhoods, and that's where all the police are. So you would think that eventually there would not be crime there anymore. If the police were actually effective to stop crime, it's not like you have, you know, the law abiding citizens in those neighborhoods saying, yes, I'm so happy all the police are here because now there's no crime. Like, if we sent all the garbage men to one neighborhood that we were calling the high garbage area, we would expect the garbage. We would sit there to eventually be able to send them somewhere else because it would have been cleaned up. But that's, it's not what's happening.
No, and it's because, like I did, most police spend their days doing and enforcing really arbitrary laws. You know, yeah. I was in units where our goal was to arrest as many people as possible. So we're looking for things like people drinking in public, smoking weed, urinating in public, loitering, trespassing. Okay, really basic broken window, zero tolerance style policing. And that does not work. And, you know, we're not attacking violent crime. We're not being proactive. Cops are reactive.
Yeah.
You know, Baltimore had 348 homicides last year. Population is only 600,000. You know, New York City had less homicides and they're a city of 8 million.
Wow.
So you see, there's some sort of huge disconnect there in terms of like how communities are whatever policed, how they're funded, you know, it's just, you know, it's amazing to me that in Baltimore, the way we police, the style we used, and we've had five straight years of over 300 murders. So the police aren't stopping violence. You know, they react to it. But again, you know, I was there, I did it. I know how they react to violence. If there's a shooting or a homicide in any particular neighborhood, that area is flooded with police. And we were instructed to make as many arrests as possible. So once again, we're just right back to making really petty arrests. And
after the homicide, not
exactly after the homicide.
How does that solve anything related to the homicide to arrest people for drinking on a stoop after a homicide?
The theory behind it is if you arrest enough people, you're eventually going to arrest somebody who knows something about the homicide and is willing to talk about it. But I mean, let's be honest. it's not like we're hanging like a felony charge over a lot of these guys' heads. So if I lock you up for, you know, drinking alcohol in public and you know you're going to walk through jail and you'll be out in 12 or 24 hours, why would you risk your life to you know, cooperate with the police? Because,
yeah,
you know, people who cooperate with the police aren't really welcomed back into the neighborhood. So that's a very, again, that's a very dangerous position for somebody to put themselves into. Yeah. So, but yeah, but that's the theory behind it. You make as many arrests as possible. Eventually you'll arrest somebody. They'll give us information. We can solve the homicide. Well, it doesn't work. And really all you do is just piss off the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Because they see us coming and they know, like, oh, here they come. They're going to lock us all up.
It talking to you really puts it into clear perspective to me. Cause I remember when, I remember living in New York in my 20s, white guy in my mid-20s, when I first started thinking about this and realizing how much just neighborhoods like a couple miles away in Brooklyn were policed so differently than mine. And I remember, what was it? It was hearing stories about people, you know, being arrested for drinking in public, for, you know, drinking out of a paper bag. And I remember thinking, hold on a second. I went to like Herald Square to the park and drank in public with my friends on a blanket in the park like the other week, and nobody stopped us. We were doing it in Manhattan on like a Sunday afternoon, and wait, that's illegal? And if you think about like, okay, what if I, every single time I had ever, you know, had an open container outside, a police officer came up and, like, you know, frisked me, and maybe I went to jail a couple times. And then every other minor infraction like that I could, you know, every time I fucking jaywalk, you know, I'm shoved up against a wall.
Right.
Yeah. I would feel differently about the police. I would have a different relationship with them, and it would really change my reality and the way I moved around the city in a really powerful way.
Right. Exactly. And that goes to my point where, you know, we were patrolling these neighborhoods who didn't want us there. I mean, not that they didn't want the police there for protection, but they didn't want the police there because we're harassing them. We're brutalizing them.
Yeah.
And you know, how is that a way? I mean, how is that a way to live your life every day? And I didn't live in that community. Most of the cops I work with didn't even live in the city itself.
Yeah.
So why should we be invested? Why should we care how we treat people in any given community if at the end of the day we're leaving? This is your problem. We don't have to deal with it.
Something you also hear is that folks in those communities, you know, even the little old ladies, right, don't believe that when they call the cops will help. Like here again in my, you know, largely white neighborhood in L.A., people are like, oh, I'll call the cops because I have a problem and they'll come help me. You know, and they'll deal with whatever my situation is. But that just doesn't happen in these communities.
No. And again, the problem is that 911 has become such a default for everyone because there's no other option. So many other services are so underfunded that when you need help, your option is the police. You know, you call 911. What do they ask you? They usually ask you police or fire. Mm-hmm. So those are your options. So if you're in some sort of crisis or you're having some kind of problem and you don't know who to reach out to, you call 911. And more than likely, you're going to get a cop who's not qualified to help with most problems. A cop who only knows how to, well, my solution to everything is arrest.
Yeah.
If I can't arrest my way out of it, I guess I'll have to tackle it. You know, I mean, I mean, basically, that's how I was trained to deal with people with mental health issues. You know, we didn't receive any specific training in how to deal with people in crisis. We would try to talk them into going to the hospital voluntarily. If they didn't listen, it usually ended with us forcibly taking somebody to the ground, putting them in handcuffs, putting them to a police wagon or an ambulance, and forcing them into the hospital. And who does that help? And we're taking them to emergency rooms that may or may not have a psychiatrist on staff. And then once they're, you know, the hospital's like, well, okay, oh, they don't have, especially if they don't have insurance, time to discharge them. What help did they get? They're going to come right. They're going to come right back home and go through the same problem tomorrow or the next day or the next week. And then here come the police again.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you more about how we can change the police, change how we police in America. But we have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with more Larry Smith.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, we're back with Larry Smith. I want to ask you about this. I have read a theory or a way of looking at the police that made a lot of sense to me, especially as regards police shootings, like, say, the Philando Castile shooting, incidents like that. And the analysis was that police officers in America are fundamentally scared. One of the reasons being because there are so many guns in America that, for example, the number of guns on the street is part of what creates like a psychology of always being under threat. I remember reading a story by like an Australian who was in the US and got pulled over for a traffic stop. And in Australia, when there's a traffic stop, you get out of your car to talk to the police officer. And this Australian guy, so he gets pulled over and he gets out of his car and the cops are immediately like down on the ground, and, you know, pull their guns. And he's like, finds himself face down. Because he didn't know the norm in the U.S. of like you keep perfectly still and keep your hands on the steering wheel. Right. And he said, I didn't realize how much police officers feel that like the citizens are a threat to them. When I learned that and went back and looked at the Philando Castile shooting, that made sense to me. Oh, my God. That officer was frightened for his life of just a guy who he pulled over. That's not a justification in my mind. That's like a systemic like wound that is like causing this. I don't know. Does that make sense to you? Does that jibe with your experience at all? Or does that sound totally off base?
No, I think it's correct, because all the training I went through is fear-based training. The cop who killed Philando Castile actually went through a program called Bulletproof Warrior.
I've heard of this.
What is this? Again, fear-based training classes that treat everyone as a threat to you. So you were saying that because of there's so many guns. Well, okay, but we have a gun as cops, so we bring a gun to every incident. Like we bring a gun.
Sure.
Car stop, call, whatever. There's always a gun there, and it's yours. So a lot of the training I went through was, you know, weapon retention. People trying to take your weapon. So like you learn how to maybe like press your forearm down on it, or keep your gun turned away from somebody so they can't lunge for it or grab for it. Again, there are a lot of police, and there are a lot of police involved killings where he went for my gun. He tried to take my gun. I mean, Rashard Brooks is another example because he took one of their tasers. So again, you have cops who were disarmed. It was a less lethal weapon, but they were still disarmed. So that's the fear-based training that we receive, is that everyone at all times is plotting to hurt us, to take our weapon, to kill us. You know, so there are trainings that, you know, de-escalation training was something that came out of the last round of reform. Post 2015, de-escalation training was something that was emphasized. Well, instead of escalating force, we're going to learn how to de-escalate situations. But we see that that's not happening. And it's hard. It's hard to teach a cop de-escalation while at the same time you're still teaching them that people want to hurt you.
Yeah.
So it's not just the guns. It's like the overall mindset and the culture and the training that is like training cops to react in this constant way.
It's the constant us versus them mentality that's being driven into the cops' heads, that everyone is potentially harmful to you.
And how do police unions play into this? I mean, look, I'm a union guy. I'm in two unions. I think everyone deserves to be in a union, right? I certainly believe that, like, hey, there's no reason police officers shouldn't be allowed to collectively bargain on principle, but police unions seem to be something different, and there's been a lot of conversation about that. What's your perspective, having, I assume, been in one?
Yeah, I was in one. You actually have the choice. You don't have to be in it. Most cops are. Primarily because if something goes wrong, you know, they'll provide you a lawyer to represent you. You can call them if you have a grievance or something. But I think police unions are poisonous. I don't think cops are workers. You know, most police union presidents, Pat Lynch in New York, Kroll out in Minneapolis, you know, they're like showmen. They're like carnival barkers. They get in front of a camera and they put on an act. And again, but you know, and they emphasize the us versus against them. You know, especially Pat Lynch in New York City. He everyone's against the police. The governor, the mayor, the citizens, everyone's against the police. The poor police are the victims. So that's what they do. They go out and they get cops, you know, really fired up. The other really kind of evil aspect of the police union is the way they can hold governments hostage. You know, if the police union is against you, they did it in Baltimore. They're doing it. They did it in New York once. They're threatening to do it again. If the police union is against you as a mayor or a politician, the police are going to stop working. You know, you've lost the respect of the police. You're not backing us. We're going to stop. So and that's what the police want. They want to see violent crime soar. They want to see crime rates go up. And I mean, they're literally holding somebody hostage. You know, they're willing to sacrifice the safety of citizens to get back at a politician they think has wronged them somehow.
Yeah, to me, the question of whether police are workers is a really interesting one, and I'm curious to hear more about why you think they aren't. To me, I mean, a strike is that's the resort of any union, right, is to withhold labor. But there does seem to be something special about how police like wield the threat of force in those, you know, quote unquote negotiations, like that you'll see like, oh, okay, maybe someone's not going to come to your house, Mr. Mayor, next time there's a break-in, or maybe we'll start to see like there's the fact that you know, the people who are making these threats have guns, and there seems to be a veiled reference to the use of force behind those statements that they make.
Well, I mean, you can look at it in terms of like, if sanitation workers went on strike, what's going to happen? The garbage is going to get picked up. So it's going to be, the city's not going to look good. It's going to stink. But there's another option. They can hire scabs. They can have somebody. They can have another department come out and pick up the trash. If cops stop working, who do you replace them with? What's your what's your answer?
Yeah.
There is none right now, and the police know that. And if another union goes on strike, you don't see cops out there arm in arm with them supporting them. What police union? What union has ever been supported by an FOP when they go on strike? And even occasionally you see companies call the police because there's picketers or there's protesters outside and the police come in and push them away. How could they be part of the, how are they workers? How is there any solidarity between those kinds of unions?
Yeah. I joined the picket line for the Teachers of LA last year. No cops on the picket line. I was there as a writer, as a fucking member of the writers union.
You don't see cops in uniform coming out and walking around holding a sign supporting teachers, especially their horns as they go by, a job like teaching. If teachers get more money, that may mean less money for cops. Come on. They don't support workers. Those unions aren't there for workers' rights.
And I remember being in New York when there's this moment where, Bill de Blasio ran and talking about like, hey, when he ran, he was like, hey, I have a black son and I have to tell my son, here's what to happen. And if you get stopped, here's what to do if you get stopped by the police. And that's a conversation, parents of black kids have to have. And, that's something that we should change in the city. And it was one of the reasons I voted for him. I was like, oh, yeah, hey, finally someone's talking about this. And then a couple years later, relationship between him and the police got so bad that the police turned their backs on him at the funeral for a few police officers, I believe. And I remember that moment and thinking that is incredibly fucked up, because what if like our military did that to the president, any president, and said, this is how little we respect you. We're not going to look at you. Right. We're not going to do what you tell us to do. Right. We're not going to obey orders. Well, you're halfway to a coup if the military does that, right? You're like, oh shit, our government's going to get overthrown. And that's sort of what is happening in our cities to a certain extent.
Well, but look what they did. They just did to his daughter during the protests. She was arrested and they basically doxed her.
Yeah. They said that like the police union put out a statement that was like, oh, the mayor's saying stuff on TV while his own daughter is like a thug throwing rocks or something like that, and posted her arrest report, an image of it.
And I mean, like, you just what other union would do that to somebody? Is like the Plumbers 101 gonna post de Blasio's invoice from a toilet he had fixed or something? Like, oh, look, he stiffed us.
Yeah. But it still seems like the core of why police unions are so bad has to do with like the institution that like we as cities, like our politicians have created.
A police union will fight. All they do is fight against transparency, reform, anything. Again, if like I said earlier, if you want a cop's personnel file, those things are protected. A lot of states have what are referred to as law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, which is basically just a second set of laws for cops to protect cops if they get in trouble. Mm-hmm. Anytime a state or a city tries to weaken one of those or get rid of it, the police union is there to fight it. So the police union will always fight for the cops when it comes to transparency, accountability, reform. They never want to give anything up. And so what they're doing is they're out there protecting a violent, racist institution. That's why I say they're poisonous. Pat Lynch loves to get on television and carry on. I mean, he loves a camera. You can look at any union president and they're just the worst. They're just the worst examples of cops. But at the same time, they're also the perfect example of cops.
Yeah. They also are always incredibly involved in local politics. Like, they funnel tons of money into, at least here in LA, into city council campaigns. They're like one of the major one of the major players.
Right, and that's why city councils across the country will rubber stamp police budgets because they don't want to be on the wrong side of the FOP. The FOP donates, they endorse politicians, so no one wants to be on the wrong side of that.
Yeah, that's how we end up with, like, here in L.A., half of our discretionary budget, more than half, is going towards the police as opposed to anything else, which is why we're getting these calls to defund the police. But do you feel there's something deeper, like, you know, obviously police unions are putting a lot of pressure on politicians to have those budgets go up every single year, to increase overtime, to, you know, in L.A. they have all these crazy ways where the cops can keep working and get their, like, pensions early. So they end up, like, making millions, like, while right. they're, you know, still working, all of these sorts of things. But is there something cultural in American society, in American cities as well, that has caused us to create this state of affairs?
We've created a world where, like I said, our only option is the police. When all you have is the police, and that's what's constantly thrown out there as a solution to everything, that's the mindset. Like, you know, I'll go back to a white middle class person in the suburbs. Their mindset is the police keep me safe. But how are they keeping you safe? Mm-hmm. You know, so people are like hardwired to believe that the police are good. The police protect us. The police keep us safe. And
right, you taught that as a little kid. You know, it's in the fucking Richard Scarry books. Here's the police man. He keeps you safe.
As police budgets grew and all the other budgets shrank, you know, we created this monster, and now it's here, and now the object is, how do we reverse it? And that's what defunding the police is all about. And you know, a lot of media has picked up on defund the police, and a lot of people have picked up on it because a lot of people don't read past a tweet. So if an abolitionist tweets an article, read the article. Like, actually read what defund the police means, because defunding the police is the first, it's not a slogan, it's a demand. And it's the first demand into abolishing the police as we know it. You know, as you strip their budgets down and take those hundreds of millions of dollars away, in some cities it's billions of dollars, and reinvest it in the communities that need it, you know, fund proper social services, addiction, mental health treatment, schools, access to food, healthcare, and you start to treat the causes of crime and violence. As you take some of the responsibilities away from the police, it's important to also shrink the police, because most of the police department budget goes towards officer salaries. So you've got departments like New York City with 30,000 cops. I think Los Angeles has 14 or 15,000 cops. You know, these are armies. These are literal armies. So as you defund them, as you take responsibilities away from them, you need to shrink them. And eventually you shrink them into, oh, look, there's no more police. You know, Los Angeles is taking the first step. I think San Francisco has announced it too, where they want to start having mental health professionals and counselors respond to certain calls. Neighbor disputes, people in crisis, things like that. Non-emergency calls, remove the police from the scenario. And that's a great first step. But like I said, as you remove the police from those scenarios and you take those responsibilities away from them, it's important to shrink the departments so you can keep defunding them. Because if you just take the responsibilities away from them, you're going to have a lot of cops with a lot of free time on their hands. And they're going to just look for things to do. And we know that never ends well. Because that's going to be, more car stops or more stop and frisks or more, you know, enforcement of quality of life crimes and things like that.
In fact, they'll do that in order to prove their own worth, to say, like, hey, look at how many arrests we're making. We must really be needed.
Right, again, and I've said this in other places, you know, the police will manipulate anything. If the crime rates drop, cops will say, well, we need more money, the same or more money to keep it down. If the crime rate goes up, well, we need more money. We need more cops. We need more right. cops. If we have more cops and more money, we could get it down. And then if we get it down, well, we need the same to keep it down. So they're constantly asking for more. Yeah. They always want more. And it's you know, governments can't keep giving them more. This just can't. Are we gonna bankrupt cities to fund the police?
It's not the '80s. Crime is at a 30-year low. You know, in the '80s there was actually a large amount of crime, or late '70s. You know, crime rates were actually much higher than they are today. As a point of fact, we have extremely low crime rates in
the
United States.
And again, you know, a lot of people when they hear abolish the police, defund the police, they say, well, what about rape? What about murder? And again, police don't prevent a lot of that now. And they're reactionary.
Yeah.
So they come after the fact. So that's why I say you need to address these problems beforehand and not afterwards with the police. Because, you know, here in Baltimore, the clearance rate for homicides is like 32%. I mean, you're talking more than 60% of the people who commit a murder get away with it. It's not going to be cleared.
And that 32%, those are just the number of people charged.
The clearance is charge somebody or they've named the suspect. That's not a trial, a conviction, and it's not always an arrest either. Because here in Baltimore, they also have a habit of pinning murders on other dead guys. Like, oh, this guy was killed and he had a gun in his pocket and that gun was used in this other murder, so he did that murder. So we just cleared that murder. So it's called bodies on bodies. It's an actual practice that they use here to clear homicides.
Wow. Well, yeah, because I mean that's their goal, right? The homicide detectives have a goal of clearing as many as possible, so they'll do it by any means necessary. And of course they're obviously, I'm sure, charging some number of people who did not actually do it. Right. So some amount of those 32% are also false.
Right. And again, you know, clearance doesn't mean that that's resulting in a conviction in court. It could be an acquittal. The case could be dropped. Or like you said, even 10 or 15 years down the road, how many exonerations are there where people have been in jail for decades for things they didn't do?
Yeah.
Because homicide cops were like, well, he did it and we'll make the evidence fit.
And it just stuns me to think about how, you know, we had Chris Fabricant from the Innocence Project on the show. And, you know, we talked about how there's this huge apparatus of police officers, DAs, whose job it is to make those charges, to charge anybody they can. Right. In order to clear those cases. And we don't hire anybody systemically in our justice system who's there to make sure that people aren't erroneously charged. There's like public defenders who barely have any resources, but it's just something that still strikes me that like we have no system built in to make sure that, you know, to be like an ombudsman, to be like a checker and like, oh wait, this person actually do it, you know? But so do you consider yourself an abolitionist? Is that a phrase you use?
Yeah. I mean, I think we need to create a world where the police aren't a part of it. We have to radically change the way that we address societal issues. We need to stop the criminalization. I mean, we criminalize everything. And I know that the argument can be made, well, especially with marijuana, it's being decriminalized, it's being legalized in states. It still uses a pretext for a lot of stops. The cops still use it to search people, to search cars. You still see people going to jail for it. So, you know, we need to, things like, you know, nonviolent drug offenses, homelessness, sex work. There's so many things that are stigmatized and criminalized, and that the police, the answer is arrest and then jail time. Well, jail time doesn't help an addict. You know, jail time doesn't help a homeless person who may be, I don't know, in Baltimore, homeless people break into vacant houses because they need shelter. And they get arrested for trespassing. But we have vacant houses that we could create housing. But instead we arrest them for breaking the vacant house and put them in jail. So, yeah, I'm definitely an abolitionist. I think there are so many ways that we can reinvest in communities and really address the root causes of crime and violence to where, you know, you don't need a cop to investigate a murder. You don't. I mean, where is it written that it has to be a cop who investigates a murder?
Who would investigate it? Like what's the role you have in mind?
You can hire and train civilians. I mean, you can give someone actual training instead of having a cop go through, you know, junk science classes like ballistics and arson. Yeah. And there are so many. Yeah, there's so many things that have turned out, especially when you look at false convictions. There are so many things the police have used to put people in jail that just turned out to be just complete junk. So you can, yeah. You know, you can train professionals to investigate crime. They don't have to be cops with a badge and a gun. I mean, they can have the power through a state's attorney or through local government, to seek out arrest warrants or summonses or things like that to, you know, charge people. But you don't need the police to do it. And if you look at a lot of these incidents, a lot of these killings aren't spawned out of anything violent. They're car stops. Eric Garner was selling loose cigarettes. Freddie Gray was just standing there minding his own business. So it's not like the cops were in this great fight against violence when they killed these people. You know, the police are causing more harm to our society than they're doing any good. And it's time to look for another. There has to be an alternative. There has to be.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a lot of what you're talking about when you're saying we don't need cops to do this is like we don't need people who are wielding force to do this. And I absolutely agree with that. That like when you have, I mean, excuse me. I mean, you know, I told a story in the intro of this show about, you know, me seeing a homeless woman, an unhoused woman on the street who was mentally ill. She was shouting for help and seeing some cops, you know, a block away, and I say, hey, that lady's shouting for help. And they were like, oh yeah, no, she's just crazy. We can't do anything. And that was really heartbreaking to me because I'm like, she does need help, right? Like we could where are the people where are the social workers, right? Who are covering the street saying, this woman's literally, she's walking around barefoot with a blanket at 11 p.m. on the Hollywood sidewalk, right? The only people we're paying to be on that sidewalk are these cops with guns, and they say we can't do anything because all we do is wield force against people, right? So I completely understand. Cut those two cops' budgets, spend that money on 8 social workers who are canvassing the streets, have them out at 11 p.m. driving around, right? And we can do that with so many different of our social ills, right? That would solve them. I'm curious, though, like, if at the end of the day, once you've mopped up 90% of the causes of, you know, civil strife on the streets, do you believe that at the end of the day, there's any role for someone employed by the city to wield force in some vanishingly small fraction of cases, or no?
No, I don't, because again, what I'm talking about is, I know I'll probably be called a nut or whatever, but I'm trying to create a, you know, perfect utopian society here where we treat problems, we treat the causes of crime and violence and homelessness and things like that to where we can eradicate it. You know, if you remove the need for somebody to, like, you know, somebody who's addicted to drugs, who maybe commits, a property crime like theft, they break into houses, maybe they even rob a store because they're so desperate for money. If we can treat their issue before it becomes, you know, an emergency for them, like I need drugs, or, you know, I'm gonna, like, I feel like I'm physically gonna die if I don't have drugs, right? If we can treat the issue before that person gets to that point of desperation, then we don't need the cops. You know, if we remove the causes of why did they rob the store, you know, if we take that away. Yeah, I mean, I'm not, look, an obvious problem in our country is the gun culture. So, unfortunately, you know, but even if you look at some of the school shootings, specifically Parkland, there was a school resource officer there. He hid behind a concrete pillar. So his presence didn't stop that. His presence didn't save anybody. He hid. He cowered.
Yeah.
While Nicholas Cruz went in and killed students. So, again, there are so many issues in our society that we have to address. That, you know, where we don't rely on force to solve problems when they do occur.
Well, let me, I agree with you on principle. I want to push on you just a little bit. Because, you know, I think there are maybe some folks listening who would say, well, hey, you want to create a utopia, but we're not going to live in one. You're going to have some folks who behave, you know, let's eliminate everybody who there's an underlying cause, poverty, drug addiction, right, of what we're classifying as a criminal behavior. Are there not at least a few folks who are, you know, themselves violent? Or let's talk about, say, let's talk about sexual assault, right? That's something where I have trouble seeing. I'm less likely to believe that there's an underlying cause, right? That like there's just folks out there who are going to take advantage of other people, and those people need to be protected by somebody.
Okay.
Is there like how do we account for
all
that?
Right, but when you bring up sexual assault, there are numerous instances of police committing sexual assault. Police rape people on duty. They victimize people all over again. A lot of sexual assault is not reported. There's a lot of sexual assault that occurs between people who already know each other. So again, you know, you can have people who respond to reports of sexual assault who aren't cops. There's things like the House of Ruth. Mm. There's advocates and counselors and safe nurses. People can respond and properly address a victim of sexual assault instead of having a cop come in and either do victim blaming. Chances are they'll be victimized all over again if an arrest is even made and they go to trial. You constantly see prosecutors who shame the victims of sexual assault. Cops are notorious for domestic violence. So again, it doesn't have to be a cop. There are other answers to what about sexual assault. Now I'm not suggesting that we can cure somebody who is going to commit a sexual assault. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that the police aren't preventing it now. And a lot of times when they respond to calls for sexual assault, they can traumatize or victimize that person all over again. So it doesn't have to be the police. It can be somebody else.
Yeah, it sounds like there's almost, based on what you're, the more you talk about it, the more it makes me think that like there's almost nothing that the police do currently that we wouldn't be better off radically rethinking who does this and finding someone else to do it. who's empowered in a different way. Look, I'm on board. I'm trying to like, you know, map out the edges of the argument here, right? And talk about, I've talked to folks on my shows before about prison abolition, right? And then, you know, we're talking about prison abolition, which I believe in. There's still a question looming of, but there's some folks who can't play well with society. You know, there's some folks who are so injured that, you know, we need it's a more difficult question, right? And so that's what I'm interested in mapping out here, because I think those are the questions that often come up for people when they think about, you know, when the, you know, average middle class American who's not thinking about these things, white American who's not thinking about these things, here's police abolition. They have a but what about reaction.
But if you look at prison populations, and, you know, it's not like a Batman movie and you crack open the doors and thousands of violent criminals come out. When you look at prison populations, who is in them? There are a lot of people in there for nonviolent crimes, the people in there for property crimes, for you know, drug violations, for things like that. There are also people with, you know, untreated mental illness. And the sad reality is some of the largest treatment centers for mental illness are actually prisons.
Yeah.
So how does that help anybody? We're going to send you to prison to get mental health treatment. Great. Sign me up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the more I think about it, the more this focus on, like, again, the cases I'm talking about in both policing and prisons is like, it's like a 0.1%. It's like we're imagining that every single person, that every single situation needs to be treated with maximal force and maximal suspicion and you know, that we need to be kept safe from everybody. And it's just not true.
I mean, if you look at a case like Elijah McClain in Aurora, Colorado, he's a 23-year-old kid who's walking home, and his offense was he was wearing a ski mask, and somebody called him in as being suspicious. He's minding his own business.
Yeah.
And the officers tackled him, choked him, had an EMS respond and inject him with ketamine. And he died. He had heart attacks and he vomited and he died. Who were they protecting? Who was being protected then? Who was Elijah? Elijah McClain played the violin for cats. He would go into animal shelters and play the violin to stray cats. Who needed protection from him?
Yeah.
Do you have, as someone who's written about this for many years and talked about this, as someone who's a former police officer, are you given any optimism by the movement that we're seeing today? I mean, and how politicians are starting to respond to it in some way? When you look at, say, what's happening in Minneapolis, does that give you any positive
I would
feeling?
Say I'm cautiously optimistic. I think that politicians are definitely worried about their own careers, and they see that there is a definite shift and what's going on in this country. When you have politicians who are willing to discuss taking money away from the police department, I think that's a great first step. It's important, though, that they don't turn around and give it back the following year. I also think that in terms of, like, in Minneapolis, when they talk about disbanding their police department, well, but what do you replace it with? Because they're going to replace it with something. You know, Camden, New Jersey is constantly used as this sort of, like, the prime example of a town that was, the police department was rampant with corruption. It was a horribly violent city, and they decided to disband their police department. Well, but they still have the police. They just replaced it with a different police department. A lot of the police.
It's the county.
Yeah,
it's the county police department now. They abolished the city.
It's referred
to as
the Camden County Police, but it's a lot of the same officers remained. And what they gave up was there's a lot of federal enforcement in Camden. There's a ton of surveillance. There's a ton of electronic surveillance, like ShotSpotter, citywide cameras. They have these, like, sometimes they're referred to as war rooms, where they're basically like command centers where all this information is fed into. So the citizens of Camden are under constant surveillance by the police. So they may have a smaller police department, but the police are still very much a part of their lives. So it's, you know, that's why I say I'm cautiously optimistic, because if you dismantle or disband the Minneapolis Police Department, you have to be really careful what it gets replaced with. Because if you're just going to replace it with the same cops and just give them a different name, you're not solving the problem.
I mean, the more I think about does this come down to race in America at the end of the day? Like, when we're saying, okay, we're just, you know, we're devoting this massive amount of money to occupying black and brown neighborhoods that, you know, white citizens are like, oh yeah, the police, I like them. I like those guys. They don't give me any trouble, and I think they keep me safe. But actually what those forces are doing are harassing black and brown communities over and over again. And, you know, the cities, which are, you know, often have predominantly white voting populations, are voting again and again to increase the budgets of those departments. Like, it's hard to look at it just from what you're describing and think that there's anything other than, like, a project of racial suppression going on.
Yeah, it obviously is, and especially because you could take the money from that police department, and instead of flooding a community with cops, you could flood it with money. You could repair the infrastructure. You can provide better public transportation, better access to clean water and healthy food, and you know, parks, rec centers, things like that. All of these things are disappearing, but the cops are there. You know, there are departments that have police athletic leagues, and that's where the kids go after school. That's who the kids interact with. Why does it have to be cops? Why can't it be a rec center or an athletic league that's not cops?
But when you ask, like, hey, you know, white neighborhoods have parks, they've got nice streets, they've got, you know, money invested in the infrastructure, they've got community development, et cetera. Black and brown neighborhoods don't have those things. Instead, they have cops there. Why is that? Why are city governments not willing to give nice things to the black and brown neighborhoods, but instead have punitive police forces there? It's really hard to not just conclude, this is racism on the part of our cities and the people who vote for them.
Because the police are there to contain those citizens. I can't put it any simpler than that. That's what the police do. They are an occupying force. They're a containment unit. They want to make sure that people who are comfortable out in the suburbs don't see the problems down in the city. And I went through this with the opioid epidemic. I started as a cop in 1999, and I saw a lot of people who were affected by opioid addiction. And I didn't see the media attention that's being given to the problem now. I didn't see money being thrown at the problem. I didn't see, we didn't carry naloxone back then for overdose victims. We called a medic and we waited. But as soon as white kids from the suburbs started coming in and buying drugs and going home and overdosing, or they were getting into, pills that were being sold, or they were taking their parents' pills or whatever, then it became an epidemic. And then we had, now we got to treat it. It's a national emergency. I mean, it's literally been deemed a national emergency. Well, it wasn't a national emergency in 1999.
Yeah.
When I was watching people drop dead in Baltimore. So it's things like that where it's like, obviously this is an issue of white and black. It can't be anything else.
Yeah.
It can't be.
Well, let's find a note to we should wrap up at some point, and I want to see if I can get us to a slightly more hopeful place here. So when we're facing this stark reality, and I really hope that folks listening to this are staring at it head on at this point after hearing this conversation, what do you advise the average person listening to this to do? Whether, you know, is it how they look at the cops differently, or what, how they pressure their local governments, or what do you hope the takeaway that, John and Jane Q Public, who haven't been thinking about these things for the last couple decades, take away from it?
Well, I think the main thing is I really want specifically young white people to really challenge their perception of the police and what they think the police do and how they think the police keep them safe. I also think it's important for people to really read. I'm not saying you have to become an abolitionist, but at the very least, we need to take money away from police departments. So at least look into what it means to defund the police, to take money away, and other places it can be spent. Don't just scroll down. Don't just doom scroll down Twitter. Like actually do some reading, do some research. And just challenge your politicians. When you do the research, and if you think that the police deserve less money, call, email, go to a protest, make your voice heard.
Larry, thank you so much for coming on and talk to us about this, and for your, thank you for speaking up about this at all when so few do. Your voice is really invaluable here, and I can't thank you enough.
All right. Well, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank Larry one more time for coming on the show. I hope you got as much out of that conversation as I did. Hey, if you liked this episode, please leave us a rating wherever you subscribe. It really does help us out and help other people find the show. And that is it for us this week on Factually. I want to thank our producers, Dana Wickens and Sam Roudman, our engineers, Ryan Connor and Brett Morris, Andrew WK for our theme song. You can find me at Adam Conover wherever you get your social media or at adamconover.net. And until next time, we'll see you next week on Factually.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.